Alcoholic. You came back this early in the morning. This must be the some are sicker than others bunch to want to come back to this, but I'm glad you're here. I'm glad I'm here. You want to join me? We'll open with a set-aside prayer. Lord, help me to set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about others, and everything I think I know about my own recovery, all for a new experience in you, Lord, a new experience in myself, a new experience in my fellows, and a much needed new experience in my own recovery. Amen. We're starting the section on step two. Page 44 begins the chapter, We Agnostics. A chapter that I have found myself in over and over again. It starts off on page 44 with an interesting concept, a two-pronged concept of alcoholism. It says, in the preceding chapters you have learned something of alcoholism. We have hoped we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. And if you were, I'm not going to read it, but on page 20 and 21, it talks about two different types of drinkers that could easily be referred to as alcoholic. But the one person has the ability within them, if they really make up their mind with a sufficient reason, they have the ability to stop or moderate on their own. We see that in Alcoholics Anonymous. We see it around the world. Men and women who get in enough trouble and they just swear to themselves they're never going to drink again, and they don't, and they're fine. Their alcoholism ends where the bottle ends. Or people that drank abusively or self-destructively for a period of time because of an emotional problem, and they come into Alcoholics Anonymous and they don't really connect with a lot of the alcoholism, but they connect with having it have been a little drinking too much, and then after 7 or 8 or 15 years they realize they're not alcoholic and they can return to drinking successfully. And I'm neither one of those people. And you know why I know that? Because I've tried to be those guys. Almost killed me. We must play the hand we're dealt. And here's the two qualifying things that it says. It says, if when you honestly want to, like no kidding around, I really mean it this time, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. What do they mean by entirely? I mean, they don't really mean entirely. I mean, what about light beer? What about expensive, good, naturally fermented wines? What about marijuana? That's organic. What about something for my emotions from a doctor? See, I could quit entirely. I could quit for periods of time if you kept me properly medicated, or give me something else, or maybe a new job and a new girlfriend for a little while. But I could not quit entirely. Or, and I've always suspected it really should say and, but if the book says or because they want to open the doors to as many people as possible, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. And we talked about that last night, that phenomenon of craving. That I unleash something inside me from an allergic reaction to alcohol. And the reason I've always suspected, I've often wondered, why do they say or? Because when you think of it objectively, having only one of those two things, you wouldn't need AA. You have to have both. Because think about it. If I could quit entirely when I honestly want to, well, let me tell you something. I'd have done that and never come to this leper colony and make amends and go to meetings and take commitments. Are you kidding me? I'd just quit entirely and been fine. or if I could have not quit entirely, kept going back to it, but when I would go back to it, I could moderate the amount I drank, I had control over the amount I drank, I'd be drinking today. So for me to be a desperate, 100% all-in member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had to have both of those things, in order to cut away my options. Because if I could have done either one of those two things effectively, man, I would have been doing it. I'd have been doing it. The book goes on to say, to one who feels he is an atheist or an agnostic, it follows that up by saying, if that be the case, if you have those things in place, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And here's where I ran into problems. I remember sitting in a meeting in a treatment center up in Waterville, Maine, listening to a guy who was a convict, and he was, boy, an amazing story. And I'm with him every bit of the way. I'm identifying. I'm sitting there nodding my head. And then he talks about going to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in prison and finding God. And the minute he said finding God, it was like a steel door slammed in my head. I remember sitting there going, oh, what have they done to him? Oh my God, he's one of those people. He's a freaking sunbeam for Jesus. Oh my God. I just discounted everything he had said as a result of that, because I had so much prejudice about God. And it's really fear. See, here's the kind of guy I am. If I just suspect that you might not like me, I'm going to not like you first. And I had this sense about God that if there's a God, he ain't going to warm up to a bum like me. He can warm up to some of you nice people, but you see, you don't know what I've done. You don't know some of the sleazy, horrible stuff I did that broke the hearts of some very, very nice people. And so I fancied myself an atheist. But I'm not. I don't know that any of us really are. And then one of my favorite lines, right in the middle of 44, it talks about our two alternatives. And it's kind of a funny line. I don't know if Bill's trying to be funny, but to me it's a funny line. He says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death. Now, the word doomed is not a happy word. To be doomed to an alcoholic death, which, when you look at it objectively, has to be the absolute worst way to die. I can't imagine a way that you could die that would be more lonely, more self-pitying, more full of remorse and shame, more full of self-loathing than when you die of alcoholism. I had a guy sponsor had a recording that was on. He eventually erased it. I wished he would have made it. We passed it out of a voicemail he got from a guy that he sponsored, who went out and he called him from some sleazy little motel in the middle of where all the crackheads and prostitutes work in the worst section of Vegas. And if you could have heard this voicemail, it sounded like what you would imagine tortured, tormented people in hell would sound like. He was shrieking into the phone and sobbing and then cackling, and then it was the most horrifying thing, and it was right before he killed himself. And this guy, this was a tortured, tortured person. So doomed to an alcoholic death, probably the worst way to die. The loneliest, most self-loathing way to die. Alternative number one. Or to live on a spiritual basis. Door number two. spiritual basis, doomed alcoholic death. And then the book says something that's funny but true. For us, those are not easy alternatives here. And it's bizarre, but how many people here take meetings into detoxes or county jails? Thank you. You guys are the guys that saved guys like me. You go to some of these low bottom places where people are dying of alcoholism, and you present this program to them, this spiritual way of life. And how often they'll sit there and think, oh, no, I mean... And even if you sit and talk to them and convince them they're going to die of alcoholism, it's like they still choose that road. They still choose that road. And that's only in alcoholism. If you were to go into a hospice where people are dying of cancer, and you were to say to them, hey, we got something that has worked for over 4 million terminal cancer patients that has allowed them to live a normal lifespan and be free, they would beg you to tell them what to do, and they'd jump on it. You do that with alcoholism because of the nature of the alcoholic ego. We don't want it. You know, we'll see. And it's bizarre. Alcoholism is the only disease I know of that you can't be treated against your own will. And the will of the alcoholic resists getting better. How often do we sit in meetings and you can't shut this thing off? And what's this thing do? It picks apart everything that's being presented to you. It will find fault with it. So page 45 starts to talk about the real nature of this, of the problem. And in the first full paragraph it says, lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. Obviously. If you have failed to do one of two things, and that's to correct both of the things in the beginning of this chapter. If you have failed and failed and failed at controlling your drinking once you started, it always eventually gets away from you. And you failed in turning yourself into the kind of person that doesn't have to keep going back to it. In other words, if you failed at drinking and you failed at not drinking, man, then you really do lack power, don't you? You don't have the power to change the way you are sober into a guy who's really happy enough and enthusiastic enough and free enough sober to be live without alcohol. And you don't have the power to change that thing that happens to you once you start to drink so that you could get back to the days when there was magic in it, and there was fun, and there was freedom, and there was conviviality, and there was all of that. I really lack power. That's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. And here is a point at which we lose a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because they misinterpret what they observe here. And what you'll hear people in meetings say something that you'll hear me say it from time to time that is absolutely true and yet misinterpreted. And what that is I will tell you the truth, and the truth is I am sober today only through the grace of God. And that is the truth. And yet, upon hearing that, a lot of us leave AA incrementally and shift ourselves into a church. Now, there's nothing, churches are wonderful. They're just not a treatment for alcoholism. If you shifted yourself into a church and still maintained an enthusiasm for AA and worked the steps, you'd be fine. But what happens is people bleed themselves out of recovery in the 12 steps in an Alcoholics Anonymous and go there exclusively. Because it's almost as if they think that what the dilemma is lack of religion or lack of faith. But it's really neither one of those. It's lack of power. I've been fortunate, or I guess fortunate, to work with, over the years, at different times, with four different members of the cloth clergy. Two of them drank themselves to death. I remember the first time this happened, this guy Frank, it blew my mind. And I'm not talking about a rogue, deviant priest. This was a good guy. He was an amazing man, very kind-hearted, and had more information about God than probably anybody I've ever met. Prayed more in one day than most of us will pray in a week. Read more spiritual literature. And he called me up about a week before they found him. He literally drank himself to death. And he had started drinking again. And he was weeping and sobbing into the phone because he could not understand why a man who has dedicated himself to his church, dedicated himself to God, could ask God to keep him sober. And he was drinking again, and there were bums in AA staying sober. And it didn't make any sense to him. And you know something? It didn't make any sense to me either. Because if we're sober through the grace of God, you'd think a guy like that would have a leg up on a guy like me. I mean, I would think so, wouldn't you? But it wasn't lack of faith or lack of religion that was Frank's problem. It was lack of power. And here is where Alcoholics Anonymous is a little bit different than most spiritual approaches. We know something here. One of the first things that Bill Wilson ever realized came from the first book he ever read in sobriety. It was given to him in Towns Hospital by Roland Hazard and Evie Thatcher. It was a book called The Varieties of Religious Experience by William James. Very difficult book to read. I've read it twice since I've been sober. Hard book. But William James did a scientific style study of people who had born again, conversion, epiphany style experiences that seemed to change them. And the two things he realized in studying these people with some consistency is an alcoholic never had one of those experiences when things were going well. It was always when you were broken. As Dr. Harry Thiebaud would talk about, your ego had to have been crushed. And you had all your self-will, and all, you know, the part of you that judges, the part of you that thinks it knows crap, had to be crushed. Had to be crushed. And then it was crushed, and the thing that was separating you from God was diminished, and some light could come in. And then the second thing that James realized in studying these cases is that invariably these religious conversion, born-again experiences were transitory. In other words, for some reason that no one really understood is that they would wear off. And very subtly, the old ego would eventually rise up. Except now it rises up within a structured spiritual context, and you don't know it, because now your ego will take all this, everything you've learned in church or everything you've learned in AA. How many times do we see people's ego rise up and waving flags of the 12 traditions in the big book and using it to beat other people over the head and to grandize ourselves? As if now I feel smugly superior to the uninformed or the sinners or the whatever. And the ego will use anything. It will use anything to grandize itself. Harry Thiebaud, Dr. Thiebaud used to talk about the amazing recuperative powers of the alcoholic ego. It grows back like a bad tumor. It's persistent. It's resistant. It's clever. It learns. And it's smart. And it has, I think it has stronger survival mechanisms than we do as human beings. How many of us have been to those places where we're risking our life? Where it almost as if the ego doesn't even care if it kills you, as long as after you're dead everybody realizes how right you were. It's lack of power. I live in a city in the desert where in the summertime it can get to be 115 to 120 degrees on a couple days. And if you were to come out there and visit me in Las Vegas, I could, in the summer, when it's 115, I could take you in my car and drive you about 40 minutes outside of town and take you to one of the largest bodies of fresh water in the western United States, Lake Mead. And I could drive you up to the edge of the lake. I'd let you get out of the car, let you jump in the lake, swim in the lake, let you drink the water of the lake. And you could obtain absolute faith that that water's there. For God's sakes, you drank it and you swam in it. And then stick you back in my car, drive you a little bit out into the desert, let you off on the side of the road in the desert with a map showing you exactly where I let you off, with a step-by-step directions on how to get from where I'm letting you off back to that water. Do you know that you could walk around that desert if you and die of thirst, knowing and having absolute faith that that water's there, and still die of thirst if you do not follow the directions to get you to the water, and you will die with complete faith that the water was there? And when Frank was weeping to the phone, he was weeping because he knew God was there. He just could not make the contact. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk about something here that's a little different. We need something beyond faith here. We need what is referred to as conscious contact. And there's a tremendous difference between faith and conscious contact. When you go home from here, you can go get in your car and drive down the street with absolute faith that there are police out there. You better drive the way you're supposed to drive. You have absolute faith there are police out there. You get a cop in your rear view mirror with his lights on, you've got conscious contact. The one is experiential and the other one is theoretical. And Alcoholics Anonymous, because our very lives are at stake, is trying to take us out of the theoretical and into the actual. Into a faith that works. That we actualize. On page 46, talks about two things that are so simple. What my big fear in the years I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, my fear was is that I thought that I couldn't get sober until I believed. And see, I'm not wired that way. I can't believe something because you tell me. I mean, even if I know I should, I'm such a skeptic. I think emotionally I must be from Missouri, the show me state. You know what I'm saying? I can't do it. I'll placate you, tell you I believe. But the truth is, doesn't mean I'm convinced in here. And I thought I had to believe, and I don't. I have to do these two things. The middle of page 46, it says, yes, we have agnostic temperament. Have had these thoughts and experiences. Let us make haste to reassure you. First thing, we found as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice. Well, that sounds simple, doesn't it? But it's not really. Because the problem, if you have an ego like mine, you have, what's prejudice? Prejudgments. And if you have an ego like mine, you can have a whole bunch of judgments and not realize you have any, because those aren't judgments. That's really the way it is. The ego is incapable in the middle of a judgment wondering if it's wrong. I don't know, have you ever been judging something as this awful or terrible in the middle of that thinking, oh, that could be wrong. No, you're right. I mean, I'm thinking it must be right. So what happens is that I have all these prejudices and I don't know that I have them. And some of them are unconscious or subconscious. I found one to be very common with most of us. And that is a deep seated, unconscious sense that God judges us. A deep seated, unconscious sense that on my very, very worst day, the day where I just did something I'm very, very ashamed of, at that moment, God's not going to be there for a guy like me. Now, that is not a conscious thought. It is an emotional, unconscious sense. And all the education in the world, all the intellectual knowledge that God loves me, it said, they told me that, and everything, AA, and I know God, like, et cetera, doesn't really change that emotional disposition. That it seems somewhere to be tied to my sense of myself, which is where the unworthiness comes from. Father Martin one time said that when intellect and emotion are in conflict with each other, emotion always wins. I can intellectually know God loves me, but if I feel unlovable, I turn away from the light. I always did. I was over in Florence a couple years ago, and I went and I saw a statue of I'd heard about it, and I really wanted to see it in person, of a statue of Mary Magdalene by a sculptor named Donatello. I have a picture of it later at the break if anybody wants to see it. And when I went to see this statue, in seeing it, it just took my breath away. I remember walking into this room, and I didn't see it at first, and I saw there was a big crucifix on the wall, and I turned, and then I saw the Mary Magdalene, and it was unbelievable. Here's a statue not unlike any depiction of Mary Magdalene you'd ever see. This is not a woman with pretty hair and long robes and very beautiful. This is a woman who has been beaten. A woman that's evidently suffering from malnutrition. A woman dressed in rags, dirty, filthy rags. A woman who someone had kicked her teeth out, and there's these broken little stubs. A woman who had a sense and a countenance of shame, as if she'd been turning nickel and dime tricks on the back alleys of the Middle East for years. And she's standing there with this. Her head is tilted just a little bit, and her hands are like this. And they're not in prayer. There's a hesitancy in her hands as if she doesn't feel worthy to pray. And she's looking up, and I look to see what she's looking up, and she's looking up at the crucifix with this expression on her face as if she was saying to God, this could be for me? For me? And I'm standing there, and I'm looking at the broken teeth and where she's looking and the hands, and I just start sobbing. I couldn't help it in a public museum. And I'm not a public crier. And I'm standing, I couldn't help it, I'm sobbing. Because I'm looking at, this is my very soul as I came to you. This sense of unworthiness. Because that is how I think most of us come here. This could be for me? After all I've done, all the people I've hurt, the disappointment I've wrought, this could be for me? And then the second thing, it says, if we can lay aside our prejudice and express even a willingness to believe. Do not have to believe, but can I express a willingness? In other words, make a demonstration. act as if. And what Alcoholics Anonymous asks to guys like me to do is not to believe, but let's position ourselves in life as if this God you don't believe in exists. Let's do what the scientists would refer to as a working hypothesis. Let's see what happens when I start relating myself to life as if behind the fabric of the universe there's some sort of power that's there to help me. And little demonstrations like physically getting down on my knees and praying to something I don't even believe in as of yet. Starting to talk throughout the day to something that I don't even think is there. And amazing things started to happen to me. From the moment of approach, from the moment I started to act as if maybe there was something there, something started to materialize in my life. It was uncanny. And I'm a skeptic, so the first 20 coincidences in my favor did not convince me. But eventually, I can't tell you how many times in early sobriety I'd be wacky about something. I don't know what's going on. I just feel horrible. My head's spinning. And I'd go to some meeting and there'd be a stranger there talking about what's going on with me. I can't tell you how many times I'd be starting to sink into another depression and the phone would ring and there'd be somebody in there having a problem with something and thought, found my number and wanted to talk to somebody. I remember one morning I went to work and my boss disrespected me. And I am enraged. He said some stuff to me. I just wanted to punch him. But he was a boxing commissioner and ex-Golden Gloves champion. I'm angry, not stupid. But I'm going to quit my job. You can't do that to me. I'm sober here. I have rights. Whenever you hear an alcoholic say he has rights, look out. I'm not a doormat. Oh, look out. Or the one that's, it should be engraved over the portal to hell. It's the principle of the thing. Oh, Jesus. I'm about ready to destroy myself when I say things like that. It's my rights. I'm not a doormat. It's a principle. You can't treat me like that. I'm sober here. And I got this intuitive thought that instead of going to lunch, and I was planning on going to lunch and coming back and quitting my job, maybe I should go to this noon meeting. And I got in my car and I went to this meeting that I'd hardly ever been to. And I get in a couple minutes late, the meeting's already going on, and I'm not even in the room. I don't think even a minute or two, and there's some stranger in the meeting, and he's telling a story about how his boss had asked him to do something, and he didn't do it. And his boss had to pull him up on it and confront him about not doing what his boss asked him to do and how it hurt his feelings and he wanted to quit his job. And he called his sponsor up and his sponsor said, no, you don't quit your job. You go make amends to your boss because you were wrong. You didn't do what he said to do and he's your boss. And I'm sitting there and he's talking about exactly what had happened to me. And I'm sitting there and even though I built this big case of how I was disrespected and everything, I could see myself through his experience. And I sat there and realized, I don't have to quit my job. I've got to go back and make amends to my boss. And I remember going back to work, and I was scared to face him and make that amends. Because I always feel like if I make amends, I'm going to be weak. And I went to my boss, and I hat in hand, and I said to him, I said, I want to tell you, I'm sorry. You asked me to do that. And I didn't do it. When you asked me about it, I gave you a lot of excuses and a lot of crap, and I was wrong. And he put his arm around my shoulder, and he said to me, he says, kid, everybody makes mistakes. And he went and told me a story about how he'd screwed up when he first got in the business. And what had been the absolute worst job on the planet, the job I am going to quit, just like that became, what a really nice place to work. Now the question is, who orchestrated all that? who's pulling the strings that got the sense in me to go to that meeting? Who brought that guy there on that day to share that exact same story? Who's pulling all of this? If you ever go over to Europe and some of the big cities in Europe, London's a good example. There are parts of the city of London that where the streets are lit by gas lamps. And years ago, before they had the technology and the electric starters, what they had was a guy or several guys that would go up and down the streets, let's say, of London at twilight, and they'd have a key, and they'd open a little door on the side of the street pole. The pole would hold the gas lamp, and they'd turn the gas on with this key. And then they'd reach up with a pole with a flame on the end, and they'd light the street light. And you could go up to the top of the highest building in London at twilight and look out over the city, and you could not see where the guy was lighting the lights, but you could see where he'd been. And I could sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at 2 years sober and not see where God was at that moment, but man, I could see where he'd been in my life. And I was very fortunate to have been pushed into 12-step work and into the trenches, taking meetings into detoxes and places like that when I was new. And there you get up close and personal to the hand of God. That's where you really get to see these hopeless cases be brought back from the abyss. And see, I could see God's hand in my life. And I guess that's the only way a guy like me, who's wired the way I am with the skepticism and the cynicism that I have, I guess it's the only way a guy like me could have come to believe, is I started acting as if God existed and He started to materialize. And I tell you something, in my sobriety, I've had periods where I've once again, unbeknownst to me, taken an agnostic stance in life. You know what an agnostic stance is? That's where you're going to meetings and talking about how wonderful God is and how you've turned your life over to God, God's in charge. And then you leave the meeting, you go to work, and you act like you're in charge. I become the hypocrite again. And from the moment I start getting into the driver's seat, what happens is the presence of God starts to fade in my life. And I think that's why Alcoholics Anonymous is an action program. The more I act like God's in charge and He loves me, the truer and the realer that becomes. And the more I act like I'm in charge, He starts to fade. Kate.
Excellent, Bob. I'm Kate, alcoholic.
Okay.
That story about the gaslight has always been one of my favorite stories that Bob tells, because I think in AA we have such a tendency to be storytellers, and that's how we do so much relating. And this particular chapter, personally for me, I didn't touch this chapter for years because I didn't think I was agnostic. I'd always believed in God, so I, you know, when you are handed the book in AA, I don't know about you, I missed formal education. I cheated my way through school. I was grateful to get a diploma, but I got no education. And then when I come into AA, they hand you a book and you go, oh, you got to be kidding me. You know, and back then there was no got it on tape kind of deal. We were still barely getting out of 8-track. So that was not a good plan for me. I didn't comprehend well. You know, the run-on sentences, couldn't spell. I could read, but I couldn't comprehend. And so I skimmed over certain things, and I really basically got the We Agnostics out of AA meetings and big book studies, and still never really got it. But I love, it's one of my favorite chapters in the book now, because I understand that I was never atheist, but I have current agnosticism, and that translates to me as, I don't think God can handle this one. I'm going to have to take over. And that's self-will. It's like, you know what, God, take away the drink problem, but I got the kids, I got the job, and I got my marriage. If I need you, though, if it gets bad, I'll call on you. But otherwise, I'm pretty self-sufficient. And it's what I was talking about last night. I have relied all my life on self-will. I left home when I was 15. I'm a woman. Well, I was a girl back then. I pushed my way through school. I mean, I am so driven that it's like what Bob was saying about the water is, I tell me I can't do it, oh, back up. I'll do it. I'll do it and more. And, you know, I was using the example of the watermelon in the pool. That came to me. I love the way the book always says, when we look back, we see this part of us. And I remembered we had the neighborhood pool. You know, it was the 60s, and they threw that greased watermelon in there, all Vaseline'd up. And they said, whoever can get it out gets it. And I almost drowned. I remember almost drowning and determined that I was going to get that watermelon out of there. I did. And, you know, I don't know if I ate it or anything, but I remember being under that water thinking, you're going to drown, and being that driven. See, when the book talks about being driven by 100 forms of fear, God's not in the picture anywhere. Period. Not anywhere. And this chapter is explaining that He is the source that I must have. And I don't know about you, that was not good news. That was not good news. When I was sitting in my first AA meeting, and I, of course, was going to work the 12 steps right off the wall. I mean, you people may need to write them, and you people may need to do a little bit more, but I'll just sit here and read them. And check off, yep. And the truth of the matter was when I saw God, I went, oh, great. We're in a cult. I knew it. It's a cult. A whacked out people, all Jesus freaks, you know. And then what I ended up grasping out of all of that, and how the book lays out so beautifully, is that this chapter says to me, all I've got to do is be willing to believe. I don't have to at that moment. You hear a lot of people in AA say, I'm on my second step. What does that mean? What are you? You waiting for the white light? You waiting for the burning bush? It ain't going to happen. That drink will come way quicker than that burning bush. We're so confused in this area, and myself included. When I say we, I'm always including myself in this deal. And what I like to—I've been in the fitness business for almost 30 years. Back when, you know, Jack LaLanne was the hottest thing in the world, and then, you know, 30 years of fitness is a long time. Now it's kind of expected, and you should work out, and you should do this, but not 30 years ago. And I tell people, I go, I'm in the fitness business, and you can tell by looking at me, I'm in good shape. If I told you that I am capable of getting you to lose 10 pounds in 1 month, give me 1 month, you work exclusively with me. You follow what I tell you to do, what I tell you to eat. You show up at the gym when you need to. Do you believe that I could pull that off for you? That's a question I'm asking you.
Yes.
You don't even bat an eye. Absolutely. You're in the fitness business. You can do that. Well, that's what we're bringing to you in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just asking you, based on my life, drunk to drunk, knee to knee, eye to eye, you believe you can have what I have. Yes, then let's move on. See, that's as simple as I make it, especially for the new guy. Because we're just convincing you to follow that your power is not working, period. If you think you're going to have some clear-cut message from God in this step, it's not going to happen. I mean, yeah, sure, you can possibly have the white light experience, but the odds are pretty slim. And if you sit on this step, God could have a bullhorn screaming in your ear and you wouldn't hear it because you're so blocked with these prejudices that it's talking about. And prejudice to me is also old ideas. My old ideas almost killed me. They can kill you in sobriety too, right? And one of the things that I love is on page 44, when it's talking about what Bob said, that to be doomed to an alcoholic death. That is the turning point. The book uses the term, we stood at the turning point. Now, the only problem with the turning point is there's no arrows. You don't even know you're at the intersection. You just have pain. How many of y'all know that one? Yeah. When you're in pain, you're actually getting ready to either turn into self-will or God's will. Now, today, I'd prefer to turn into God's will. I may give it a whole day of self-will until I'm, you know, beaten down. But the truth is I turn much faster to God's will. And that's what the book is constantly referring to, Turning Points. Page 25 also talks about it. And as we go down to the end of the bottom of that page, it says, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, oh my gosh. I mean, how many of you guys started out with this moral fiber? Right and wrong, your parents taught you well, and then you stole some candy. Kind of fun. A little bit of thrill in that. And I got it, and didn't have to rely on anybody. And then the next thing, and then you start pushing that envelope, for women especially with sex. You know, you talk about incomprehensible demoralization. I was ripping with Bob and Charlie one time about the power behind women and making the decision for sex, right? We say yes, it's on, we're on. And Bob said, I was out there doling it out, but nobody was taking the, you know, over here, Bob. You know, we girls just got to go, you want some sex? Absolutely. You want some sex, ladies? We're like, no, thank you. See, when you talk about, when you're talking to women and you're talking about that code of morals, we go down hard and fast behind sex. Just the way it is. Not that you guys don't get me wrong. But that starts checking off faster and faster for us. You can't pour enough booze in us to take that pain away. Morals, take away my children. Tell me that you're going to take away my kids if I can't stop drinking. Check it off the list. See, kids cannot sustain sobriety for you. They can darn sure get your attention. Oh, it'll get your attention. And the world sits there and looks at us and goes, you could give up your children? Absolutely. Absolutely. That's alcoholism. My passion is to work with the women in Family House back in Austin because we've got a government grant that says, actually, I don't know if you guys know this, most of us are beyond the childbearing age. Thank you, Jesus. But in Texas, they have a... I was going to go down another road. I decided not to. No, I'm going to.
Let me get buckled in.
I swear, I just cannot figure out why you guys can still be shooting the real deal at 80 years old. You know what I'm saying? We get a cutoff. You should get a cutoff too, don't you think so? Okay, I said it. So, rebuttal. In Texas, what we have is the government, or actually, I don't know where, if it's a state deal or what the law is on this, but if they believe that you might be a mother that's been using drugs or alcohol, they can drug test your baby. And if you do, you go into the hospital, have this baby, bam, in comes a social worker and says, you either go to treatment or we take your baby. Isn't that something? Yeah, that's a wake-up call, isn't it? Now, how would you like that information when you got no desire to quit at all? And they go, here's the gift. You don't get it. That's pretty painful, isn't it? And your parents are going, my God. You're going to drink behind that baby? Absolutely. See, if a mere code of morals or better philosophy for alcoholism, it'll get my attention, but it won't sustain sobriety. And so we go on and we say, down on page 45, second paragraph, tells us right there, I think Bob did a beautiful job about lack of power. I'm going to jump on to the next paragraph. Well, that's exactly what this book is about. It's telling us right there. This book is getting ready to take the journey. It says its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problems. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm going to assume the majority of our brains all think alike in here. It says, did that just tell me that God's going to solve all my problems? All my problems. It doesn't say God's going to take away the drink problem and you better take it from here. Matter of fact, you're going to have money problems, you're going to have relationship problems, you're going to have kid problems. The old idea that I believed is that when I got sober, I was going to be problem free. I don't know where I thought that. Did you guys think that? You take away the drink problem and I'm going to be fine. Well, that could mean that I'm going to lose a job. That might mean that rent's looking pretty tight. Might mean my kids get sick. I didn't think that. And when those problems started coming at me, I once again fellowed up with self-will. I got to fix these problems. And when the book says, we'll solve your problem, I want you to know that that's also discussed on page 14 and on page 63. You might want to make a little note of that. I might have 14 wrong. It might be 20. I'll tell you later. Don't write that number down yet. Is it 20? All of a sudden I went blank on my... We'll take away my problems. Oh, no. It's page 14, isn't it? My friend emphasized the absoluteness of... Yes. And so what we're moving towards is that God will solve our... Page 13, thank you. I knew I was close in that area. The bottom of page 13. My friend promised that these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which would answer all my problems. And that's what this is moving us to, right? Well, the only problem is getting us off the mark of all of our old ideas. One of the other things is we have at the bottom of this page 45, it says, it starts to talk about our childhood God. And I believe Sandy B. does such a spectacular experience about sitting in church with his sister and looking up at the crucifixion and seeing Jesus on the cross. And he's got his sister sitting next to him, and he thought, oh my God, I want nothing to do with these people. They basically nail you to a cross and leave you. And his sister went on into that same religion, and I don't know what religious denomination it was, and just became a huge part of her life. Isn't that funny that the two of them would be sitting there, blood related, and one's experience was one way and another was another. And my childhood God was, I was raised Catholic, and I don't know about you, but I mean, we drank and partied, it was in the early 60s, and he was still speaking Latin, and I don't know what you think about that, but that's where you just want to pinch your sister, flick a booger on her, try to get her attention in any way you can to get her to laugh out loud in church. I mean, didn't you feel that way? So I'll reach over there and pinch her and just upset my father, and that was what church was to us. You had to wear a little doily on your head, and I didn't get all the semantics of the deal. And then I remember my mother taking me in there and saying, you need to go into the confessional. And it's that little room in there. And I remember thinking, what is up with this? And she said, just talk about everything you've done wrong. And I went in there and I went on with it. I stole this and I did this and I lied and da da da. And I waited and I waited and I waited and nobody said anything. And I thought, oh, I am going to hell. This is not good at all. And then all of a sudden I heard this voice. He goes, my child, begin. Forget it. I've already said it. See, and he wasn't even in there. And I went, I got no sense, dude. I'm out of here. And I got, and he said, you know, say several Hail Marys and all of this. And I got out and I Hail Mary, Hail Mary, Hail Mary. You know, I mean, I so didn't get it. And I went through Sunday school and I just don't, I don't get teaching. I don't do the teaching thing well. But you can sit here and tell me a story and I get that. See, that's why I think, once again, drunks just, we're storytellers. And we tell stories and that ties it in. And that makes that paragraph come alive. And that's what I just absolutely love about Alcoholics Anonymous, is I get this loving God. You tell me to do the work, I follow the work. But I just didn't get that other stuff. And once again, in AA, I believe that I got a lot of my AA for the 10 years I was in untreated alcoholism in meetings. And I'd hear people say, I'm a recovered Catholic, you know. And I thought that was so funny. And then I read We Agnostics, where it clearly tells me I don't get to get away with that line. Right? It says we don't get to bash religious people. Matter of fact, we need to see what they have to offer us. It's amazing what happens when I read books. But some of the other things that I was sitting over here thinking about was the new guy in AA. Well, especially if you're on the firing lines and you're working with a lot of people, boy, do you get an insight of what Alcoholics Anonymous is really about. If you don't do much sponsorship, I hope by the end of this weekend you do. Because that's where you learn, A, how to carry the message, and get in touch with this power. One of my favorite lines is, got myself all mixed up on my pages here. I believe it's page 14, and it says, at the very bottom of the page, now we're talking about spiritual growth, right? We're talking about We Agnostics. It's just saying, just trust, just trust. It says, my friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others. That's pretty important. He's telling you right there, right? As he had worked with me. Faith without works is dead. It's the action that Bob's talking about. You can have all the faith in the world, the 12 and 12 says, and leave God completely out of the picture. Right? You got to have the action. And it says, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life, most people assume there's a period there. There's not. It says, through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. So it's telling me that I'm going to grow so much spiritually by helping you. I didn't see that coming. I didn't know that. I thought it was all through this prayer and meditation all. That's a very important piece of the work. But it's a piece of the work. The work, I grow so much when I see you bring a problem to me that is me. And it's like, oh, I am so blinded to self-centeredness. But when you bring it to me, God gave us the beauty to be able to see it in you. I don't know how that works. But I could take that same problem to a counselor that wasn't one of us. And you know what they'd say? Well, let's talk about your feelings. And, oh, we're entering a dark, dark spot, right? But you take it to another drunk and they say, so my problems are of my own making. Let's see where we can go with this. And that is where God, the power of God is so unbelievable in Alcoholics Anonymous. The new guy doesn't know that, first of all, they don't give us enough credit for having a solution. And they don't know how much trouble they're in. They do. The delusion of this disease is unbelievable. When somebody comes to you, They show you all their problems, right? The new guy got all their problems here. Astonishingly pile up on them. Probation, going to take my kids, going to take... And we know the problem is alcoholism. The problem's not the probation officer. The problem's not... That's the outside circumstances, right? See, God will take care of all of that if we stay close to Him and perform His work well. And that's, we're just trying to get you on this path. Man, just step a toe in that water. Step from bridge to shore. The old ideas, the prejudice, the current agnosticism, as I like to refer to it. Somebody had coined that term, my dear friend Mark Houston, coined that term, current agnosticism, and I remember when I heard him say it, I thought, what? Current agnosticism, you're going to have to explain that more to me. Prejudice, believing God can't do it. The ego, old ideas. Oh my gosh, I have so many old ideas. I have whatever, all through my life, I just picked them up and put them in a bag back there. Just drug them all through life. And the only way I really know I have an old idea is if you bug me. Right? You bug me bad enough for me to pick up the phone and call my sponsor. And she pulls out my old ideas. I go, son of a gun. You're exactly right. There's another one. Women should. Men aren't. Kids ought to be. The world is this. Politics are this. You know? It's unbelievable. And I still got so many more that I'm not even aware of. And that third column in a four-column inventory is what's going to pull up my old ideas. We had to let go absolutely. That's what this chapter is all referring to. Most people assume prejudice is based on skin. It's not at all based on skin. But that we use that term because in the 60s, for us, that was what it meant. There's a lot of words in the big book that if you get a 1935 dictionary, you'll be blown away at what he meant by them. But we hear a word, there's an old idea. You know, I have so many prejudices. Bob knows well enough, the male and female. Don't even get me started, you know. And don't think that I cook just because I'm a woman. I don't. I love to mow the yard. You know, I mean, if you talk about old ideas, people come together, two drunks come together. Oh, well, it's just fireworks. We come together with old ideas and mine are right. I love the line in the book where it says, the victor only seems to win at war. You know, people always say in AA, I always love this line, would you rather be right or happy? I want to be both. I want to be happy and right. And I'll tell you, I'd rather be happy. Oh, I am so lying. I am so lying. You know, who isn't? And you know, when it says the victor only seems to win at war, it's like when the sponsee calls you up and they have got that justifiable done wrong. And it just amazes me because it's like, well, the truth of the matter is it could be a bloodbath. And I do believe you're probably right here. Is this the battle you want to fight? Is this the battle where God's going to take away your difficulties so that victory over them may bear witness to those you would help? Because that's what we're working towards, is take away my problems so that I can help you. It's not take away my problems so I feel good, and then I'll want to help you. See, that's how I always understood that. See, I got problems, man. I'll help you when I take care of these problems. But I'm really of no value to you till I take care of these problems. Does that sound familiar? And God says, no, let me take care of your problems. You go help my kids, and then you'll look over your shoulder and you don't have those problems anymore. How did that happen? See, lack of power. That's what it's tying it all into. And, Bobby, put your watch back on. Thank you. I was glancing over at your watch. Here's the other deal. With this, we agnostics, we are completely blocked. Like I said, if God were sitting right next to me, if He were the human, that you know, the vision that we have is always that childlike God. Talk about needing it to be cast away. It would be no different if I went up to it. I quit believing in any sort of God at 9. My mother died when I was 9, and back in the 60s, everybody said God needed her. That was the catch-all line in the 60s. Do y'all remember that? Whenever anybody died, they'd always say, well, God must have needed her. I thought, well, He can kiss my... You know what I mean? I needed her. And I just shut it off right then. I thought, I'll have no business with you. Santa Claus, God, that kind of deal. And what I began to understand is that it would be no different if today At 52 years old, I go up to a 9-year-old and go, hey, listen, I'm trying to grow spiritually. You got any insight for me? Because I need the God of your understanding. Can you help me out here? Because that's what I did. When I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I brought that 9-year-old God with me. And that's what I operated on. But you see the insanity, if I were to go up to a 9-year-old and go, what do you got for me? You know, what's the God of your understanding? Help me grow here. It's amazing. It's that childhood. The rest of us grows. You know, when we go back and look at our old elementary school, doesn't it look teeny? Yeah, it looks teeny, all of this. And yet, the God of my understanding, gotta stay right there. I'm not budging off that mark. That's still the same. Everything else may look very different, right? Well, then, the other thing, too, is the book will refer to so many times is the willingness. The willingness, guys, to me, this new God of my understanding that I'm getting ready to learn about, I'm on the journey, I'm trusting that whatever it is out there. This willingness opens the door. That's all we ask. And I love the way the book ties all of that willingness into this deal, because without it, it's like the key, the spiritual key. I don't necessarily get it, but it says on page 47, second paragraph down, it says, we need to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe? That, talk about, that's all we're asking. Are you willing to be open to this idea? And we're not asking you to understand it, but that willingness in spiritual law is the difference between self-will and God's will. God said, I made you so special that I gave you self-will. Unfortunately, we alcoholics are an extreme example of it, and we don't know it. But we take that level of self-will and we burn it down, right? We burn it down. We are a tornado roaring through the lives of others. We destroy everything in our path over and over and over again, right? And that's the place we have to come back to, is saying, so you want me to surrender this self-will for God's will? This is going to be a tough piece of work, wouldn't you agree? I mean, we're not sitting here if we didn't think this is a tough job. So all I have to do is be willing to try to believe that this God's power can grow and that self will begin to drop down. And that's what happens. Now it resurfaces, but it'll go back down. And you get a lot of this pendulum swing, right? But it eventually comes back center. It always does. I think too, one last thing I want to end on before we're completely done with this chapter is, give me one more second, page 50. The promises are all throughout the book. It talks about an attitude, that we have to have a new attitude. Well, I always looked at that word and thought, I got a good attitude, let's go on. Right? I mean, wouldn't you certainly think that that's it? Well, it says on page 50, as here are thousands of men and women worldly indeed. They flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude towards that power. So it's an attitude towards that power. It's not an attitude on life. It's not an attitude on it's a pretty day. It's an attitude towards that power. And to do certain simple things, which is talking about the action. See, like I said, do you guys believe I could get you to get in pretty good shape in a month if you followed my lead? You absolutely do believe that, right? But if you sat here on your butt and did nothing, and the other half went out there and followed my lead, they're going to have the results. Because it's talking about the action. That's going to be the meat and potatoes of what we're getting ready to talk about. So it says, you have to have a certain attitude towards that power and do certain simple things. There has been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of total failure of their human resource, they found that a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into them. This happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements. Well, once again, whenever you're working with that new guy, which I always love, that big book studies are designed for you to be able to help the new guy. That's what this deal's about, right? It's carrying this message on. Instead of not just only for me, but so that I can take away my difficulties so that I can help the new guy, is it's telling me right there in that second step, we're just asking you if you're ready to do the work. Do you believe that that first step is your problem? Do you have a hopeless condition of mind and body that allergy and that mental obsession are going to take you down such a terrible path? And we're going to offer this God of your understanding, and now we're getting ready to get into the meat and potatoes of it. Thanks.
Let's take a 11-minute break.